Today's podcast is brought to you by WarbyParker.com. Get a free 5-day home try-on at WarbyParkerTrial.com/FilmWaxRadio. 5 pairs, 5 days, 100% free.
Writer-director Todd Haynes. I just directed the movie Carol, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio.
Hello and Happy New Year, everybody. It's January 4th, 2017, and you're listening to Film Wax Radio. My name is Adam Shartoff. I'll be your host. And this is the first episode of the new year. And we have one guest. I'm very excited. This is a wonderful show, wonderful episode. Years ago, I was working, producing the panel events for DocNYC, which is a New York City documentary film festival, the largest in the country, from what I'm told. And I was producing, there was a day or two of panels. I think it was actually a week of panels, now that I think about it. And one of the responsibilities that I had was to reach out to the panelists and invite them into them. And one of the panels was on documentary film editing, of course. And so I heard these three words, which I would hear frequently thereafter: get Kirsten Johnson. And if you know Kirsten's work, body of work as a cinematographer, you understand why she's at the very top of her. She's at the top of her game. She is. We'll get a lot about her background in this conversation, but she started making documentaries about, about 15 years ago. And I'm just going to read a few of the ones that she shot that I'm familiar with, going back to the early to mid-2000s. This film is not yet rated, which I believe was Kirby Dick's film. Kirby has been on this podcast. Oh, boy. Pray the Devil Back to Hell, The Oath, The Invisible War, again for Kirby, A Place at the Table, 1971, Citizen Four, which may be her most well-known work, working with Laura Poitras. She's also worked with Michael Moore. And more recently she worked on films like Very Semi-Serious, which is the documentary about the New Yorker cartoon editor Bob Raskoff, and Trapped. And now she has this film, Camera Person. It is a, if you will, it's a collage of different pieces from films she's worked on as a cinematographer, and she's put them together in this beautiful poetic expression of filmmaking, and it's just beautiful, and it's been so well received. It came out a while ago, and it's now, as I speak this week, currently back at the IFC Center, at least for this week, possibly for next week. I will post links to the IFC Center run, so you can find out the information. If you haven't seen this film, I saw it on the big screen at MoMA back at the New Directors, New Films earlier last year, and was very, very, very grateful for that. I wholly recommend you see it. It's been shortlisted for an Oscar. I guess the nominees will be listed very shortly, and I would not be surprised if she's one of the nominees, and if she wants, frankly, to win. It's a tough field this year. There's a lot of great documentaries that came out, but hers definitely belongs in that group. So I'm very happy to bring on someone who is, I'd like to consider, a friend. Her name is Kirsten Johnson. She came over to the apartment a couple of days for the New Year's, and we had some coffee. We hung out with the cat. We chatted. The mics just happened to be on. Here it is, my conversation with Kirsten Johnson.
That's pretty. Look at that yellow flower. Some amazing wildflowers here.
Is the haze working for you?
Not loving it, but we're getting pieces of stuff that don't have haze.
Was it an easy delivery, that one?
Yes, it's very easy.
He caught me.
Is it okay if I film you? Mom?
Change the subject and ask if she was always such a great dresser.
Kaže, jeste se uvijek tako fino oblačili, imali stila?
Uvijek.
Oh,
maybe you, got, like, maybe you got a juicy one on your hands.
Because normally to get to those places, you got to spend money and do illicit drugs. And
yeah, exactly.
So, yeah, so just kind of keep it
relatively... How do you feel about it? Is this good?
I think so. I'm going to put these... Do you want headphones?
I love headphones.
You do?
It makes me feel... Yeah, if you have an extra pair. If you don't, if you don't have a splitter...
No, I do. Actually, what I do, it's so rare because you don't hear people say that.
It's fun for me. I'm in the world with you. I like it.
Oh, good. Yeah. I like it too. And then you can also hear what I'm hearing in terms of how far...
Yeah.
Like, but I never push it because I figure it's my job.
Yeah.
I might go like this.
Well, for years of shooting, I would not wear headphones. And finally, my sound people mocked me so much that I was like, put them on. I was like, oh, we're making a movie.
That's funny. The anecdotes, of course, that I want.
I know. I'll stop talking.
No. It's so true, though. It's like, I would never think to ask you about that.
Yeah.
But, I do want to get into the head of, I want to talk about the movie, but I also want to get into the head of the cinematographer, too.
Yeah.
But I have, I forgot my notes.
So oof. Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I rewatched yesterday.
Oh, you did. Oh, that's so awesome. God, Nelson George has done so many things. Nelson George has done so many things. I just forget how many things he's done.
He's actually somebody. That book, I think, is what put him on the map.
Yeah. But look, he's got novels.
He does. He's a Renaissance.
Yeah.
Really, a cat, a big heavy box of cat litter in one hand. And then a bag of bagels. In
the classic.
Park. I'm like.
You're like living the dream, man.
I am.
You're totally living Parks the dream.
President.
And like getting the stuff off this dream.
And there's a box of books, and I'm like, oh dear. But this was at the kind of towards the top, and I'm like, I need to read this book because I also been, he would be a good guest also to have on.
He'd be a great guest. And so interesting to think. I mean, it's interesting, I feel like now you've got all these people who are sort of Teju Cole and whatever, who are getting this really wider level of respect being black critics talking about stuff. And it's like,
culture
this feels
critics.
He was ahead of his time a little bit.
Yeah, you totally, totally. And
1998.
Obviously he connected with the zeitgeist.
Yeah.
He's been around a really long time.
Yeah.
Even though you think, oh, this guy must be 35. He's probably like 55.
I think he's 60.
You think he's even maybe 60?
Yeah, I do.
That's incredible.
We should do a podcast with Judy Carp. She's like the sound woman who's done every movie, including tons of ones that I've worked on. She's a sound person.
Oh,
and
okay.
She's,
totally.
Yeah, but she's gonna retire eventually, and maybe she'll give you all her gear.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well.
If the Kickstarter doesn't work out.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah, then I'll have to take extra hand-me-downs for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I just need new mics, and I need. Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah, it sounds good. Yeah.
Couple of thou for hiring somebody, even if it's just for 6 months to or however
I
it
got
works.
An assistant this year, and it's been so interesting, like how much more effective I am. It's like,
incredible.
Because I really couldn't do it by myself, but
and you were trying to,
I was still, really I've been trying to for forever, and
that's great though.
Yeah,
that you did
it
that was
fun. Yeah, I don't know if I can keep her, but it's been a good time.
And also paying people's continue to call. effective people interns. You know, truth. You know,
right?
No, I mean, I think after a while, you're just going to either have labor that is not really as effective. I mean, you can hire somebody really great, by paying a little money, you get like a real assistant. You don't have to call them an intern,
right? Exactly.
Or an associate. Or
yeah. No,
whatever.
I'm all about paying everybody for their work because yeah. I know how I feel when I'm working unpaid and I'm resentful. It's like a low. They have, yeah. Even if yeah. I've like you know
or
let myself get into it. Yeah, exactly.
You know, but even there, you should get a little something. So I'd like to get some money together for that too, because I definitely do want to bring it up. Like, just my goal is just to get. Oh, I'm sorry. Do you want to sit over there?
No,
is
no,
that
no,
more
no,
comfortable.
I'm thinking. Okay. Okay.
The other thing is like just to reach out to all of the film programs at different schools.
Yeah.
That's my audience right there. That's
totally.
A generation of my audience right totally. There. Thousands of new listeners from all the different film programs around the country. It's a no-brainer, but it's, you know how much time and effort is required to do that work. So, you know, these are the kinds of projects that are on my agenda for 2017.
Sweet.
So,
sustainability.
So when I ran into you at the Criterion the second time, that was at that election.
Yeah.
The day after the election with Michael and Laura and you doing that.
Yeah.
What must have felt like a surreal
it
evening.
Was. I was going to ask you what it was like for you because it was sort of out of body experience.
It was.
We were so emotionally prepared for something
I was numb.
Different. And
yeah. And I was
to be
numb.
There with the two of them made it, it was a heightened surreality to it, right?
I guess. I mean, yeah. You know, I don't know what your the nature of your relationship with those guys are, but
I mean,
you know.
It's interesting with Michael. You know, he has so much going on that I see him very infrequently. But since Camera Person, it's been interesting that I've had a number of really powerful moments of connection with him.
Mm.
He didn't know what clip I had chosen for the film. He mm-hmm. had just given me carte blanche. And he saw the film for the first time at Sheffield. And
what was that?
It was in the UK, yeah. And it was early in the summer. And he hadn't seen the film and didn't want to know what clip was in the
before
film.
Before he saw it, yeah.
Yeah, and he spoke from the audience in the Q&A in this very emotional response. And basically, and who knows, you know, what he said was that it hadn't occurred to him how much was accumulated inside of him in relation to all of the stories that he had taken in and all of the time spent. And I think it kind of hit him like a ton of bricks watching the film.
Oh, I see what you mean. There's also a moment...
Because he's hurtling forward at all
yes,
times,
right.
Right?
There's no moment to slow it down and to really allow things to really sink in.
Yeah.
And so, and it caught him off guard. Because was it in your film, Camera Person, directed by... Kirsten Johnson directed,
yeah,
and compiled and edited and cinematographed. But who was it describing this thing about? Not oh, it was the it,
Velma.
Yes.
It was Velma, the translator in Bosnia. Is that what you're thinking of?
No,
okay,
no,
sorry.
No,
sorry to beat you.
It
to
was
your
the
own
guy.
Thought.
It was the guy in your film who was describing the sensation of crying.
No, that was Keith Forsyth.
Keith,
yeah. From 1971, directed by Joanna Hamilton.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
That's a great documentary. But he's describing this sensation of getting emotionally caught off guard.
Exactly.
And what that's like and how you don't feel sad. It just comes out of nowhere almost. And it's this overwhelming sense of emotional.
Yeah, and it's a moment
and you start to cry from the sheer, the memories and, as he said, cascading, which was the perfect way to describe. You know, it just sort of washes over you, and the next thing you know, you're just blubbering.
Yeah.
I've had that way too many times in
my
life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think in some ways it's the way violence functions. You never quite see it coming, and then you are overwhelmed by it.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting. The other night I met a man who was a Vietnam vet, and he said, wow, there are a lot of people with PTSD in your film. And I said, who? And he started naming different people. And I said, at what moment did you think that or understand that? And he said, oh, you can see it in the eyes.
Yeah. Oh, he could relate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yes. But you know, that moment with Keith Forsyth was so interesting on a filming level because Joanna had this brilliant idea to make a mock-up of the practice. It was like basically Keith when he was trying to imagine breaking into the FBI offices in 1971, had made this wooden little sculpture that had all kinds of locks in it, and he would practice picking locks.
Oh, yes.
And
that's right.
So Joanna had it rebuilt. And she'd had him describe it over the phone, and she rebuilt it. And we came to his house, and Joanna started to take it out of the bag to show it to him. And I said, no, let me get the camera going. Because, I mean, that's one thing
did
I know. Is like if
you did?
You got to be rolling in a moment like that, because you have no idea what the sudden sensational impact will be. You know, you haven't seen that thing in the 40 years, and when you see it, it's going to do something to you. And it did something to him. And what was interesting was that when Nels Bengerder, the editor who worked on Camera Person with me, and I were looking at the footage, I keep saying, I saw you, I saw it happen. And we, you know, he had this really strong emotional response. And then we kept going back into the footage, and there was nothing to see. And we realized I had heard it happen. It was something that happened with his breath.
Oh.
That I knew it was really hitting him hard.
Yeah.
But I thought I had seen it. There was nothing to see.
And then it's this interesting thing to then you just watch him describing it after the fact, and that's still having quite an incredible impact on the viewer.
Yes.
To see him. Because you're not witnessing him
actually
doing it, but you know he's evaluating.
That's right.
His having had that reaction to the key.
Yeah.
That tangible thing that brought him back 40 years.
Exactly. Know, and I think that's what's so interesting about how each of us as humans find ways to cope with these moments that hit us too hard.
Yeah.
And obviously, some of those are denial, compartmentalization. Some of those are intellectual. Some of those are displacement. There are all kinds of ways that we all cope and find strategies and even sort of trickster ways of dealing with emotion that is too much for a human being to take. And Nels and I talked a lot about, you know, how do we let people experience these moments in the film, but also not, you know, hit them too hard sideways from, and so in some ways we gave little clues, something's coming, she's going back down that hallway again, and if this is too much for you, close your eyes or, you know, leave, or, you know, but to, in some ways, to say, sometimes to let people know it's coming, and other times just to say, oops, here it came and none of us were ready for it, which is certainly what happened and happens to me when I'm shooting a lot of the time. I don't see it coming.
Yeah. Oh, it just opens up so many issues in a way. You know, it's to talk about this kind of project. You know, I think we're just talking about what we're talking about is a good way in. And I didn't see that coming, actually,
because
I just had all these notes, but they don't really amount to a hill of beans, you know, truthfully, because they're like the Vietnam vet described the PTSD that's so many of the people in the film. And I just want to take a step back for a moment for those listening who may not be familiar with Camera Person. You can watch the trailer, and it's like a little chewable bite of the overall film, but it is a series of clips, I suppose you could say, from different works, from different projects that you were the cinematographer. And
yeah, I reached out to all of the different directors I've worked with over the last 25 years and asked them if I could have access to material that had really marked me. And so in that quest, I found all of these different scenes that we put together without voiceover to describe the life of a camera person. It's a nice cat who's arrived on the scene.
You're never sure what she... This is Sam. You're not sure what she's going to... She's not the kind that will swipe at you if she comes over like this.
But she will jump on a lap.
She might do that, but she's definitely the kind of cat you have to let come to you. Once she does, if she's on your lap, petting is not an issue.
Okay.
And she's definitely checking you out.
I'll just ignore her for now.
She's checking you out. Yeah.
Checking
the more you do that, the more intrigued she gets.
I know my games.
So obviously I'm going to guess most of your colleagues agreed. These were clips that were not used in their films.
To a great extent,
to a great
The Derrida clip, for example.
Which one?
The Jacques Derrida.
Jacques Derrida, a film you made in the early part of the
yeah,
it was, century.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Back in that, actually, the 20th century it was made.
Oh, it was in the 90s?
It was made in the 90s. Oh, okay. Yeah.
I thought it was the early 2000s.
No. I lived in the 20th century.
You and me both.
It was a great time. But that clip, for example, is exactly as it is in the film. And then most of the other clips are... either they roll beyond or start ahead of what was in the film, or some things were actually never.
Well,
in the
clearly, they're right. There's sometimes a very clearly you're sort of just turning on the camera,
yeah,
or turning it off, or trying to get.
And that's we search to keep a lot of that in, to just keep reminding the audience that there is a person there holding the camera and who happens to be me.
Some of the moments like may include, well, their opening sequence. I'm going to tell people that I saw this movie at New Directors.
New Films.
Was it New Directors?
Yeah,
right?
It sure was.
You were there.
Yeah,
I saw you in MoMA. And then I brought up that post-election evening, which was supposed to be, a conversation about camera person and about your relationships with the three of you, but turned into something of a post triage.
It was the day after the presidential election, and Michael Moore and Laura Poitras joined me for a conversation.
This is Criterion, and the reason I bring it up again is because they handed us copies of Camera Person because they're distributing. Janus Films is distributing the film, and so I was able to just put it on yesterday and rewatch. So when I describe these moments,
they're fresh in your mind.
They're very fresh in my mind, and I'm really grateful that I did do that because I think that's there was really no other way I would have. Remembered quite
as
much.
People talk about having very different emotional experiences every time they see it.
Yes.
Because it has, it's very fragmentary.
Yeah.
And so I think depending on your state of mind or what you have experienced or haven't experienced, different things hit you differently.
Yeah. It definitely benefits from a second watch for sure. So
wait till the third one.
That's when it really explodes. I'm just remembering, and I'm grateful that you brought up the PTSD aspect of it, because definitely there are, in that you embed yourself, I guess, or infuse yourself in so many projects that are political.
Mm-hmm.
It's not such a surprise that you're going to meet women in whether it's Liberia or
Darfur.
Yeah. Was it Nigeria where the...
It's in Kano, Nigeria, at the Mohammed Murtala Hospital.
At the hospital.
Yeah.
Where the... I guess she's a nurse.
Yeah, she's a nurse midwife.
Nurse midwife who's delivering babies. And she seems to have PTSD.
Yeah.
I don't know how else you describe it, because she is dealing with life and death every...
Right, and under-resourced.
Under-resourced.
Finding the way to continue on and
how do you deal with seeing so much tragedy, and she's kind of coping in her own way, even though you can't really read it.
Yes.
It's not, but having watched it a couple of times, you start to understand what's going on. You know, you see, because you can anticipate it, because you've seen it already, you're able to kind of sort of start thinking about her body language, her expressions.
And, one of the things that's so gratifying about documentary camera work is that if you stay with it and have patience with it, it always yields this kind of insight that is more there. There's always more than you thought there. So, I may be in a country where I don't speak the language or meeting someone for the first time, but if I'm truly being observational in my shooting, later in an edit room, or even later, years later, decades later, you'll watch the footage and there will be reveals.
Mm-hmm.
Say, I'm looking at your hand now and the way that you're holding the pen and sort of, moving your thumb back and forth across it. I would get that in a wide shot. And at a certain point in filming, I might just zoom in on your thumb. And then if we were filming you over the course of years, way on down the line, there would be something that would happen. That if we juxtaposed it with this moment and your thumb moving on the pen, there would be an emotional reveal. We would know something more about you. Mm-hmm. And that's been consistently true for me in this work, that you're observing someone being, and if you've truly got this vibe on that's real, where someone isn't trying to perform for you,
right,
then you are seeing aspects of their self that will continue forward into history.
Mm.
And you can just trust that. You know it's there.
Yeah.
And this is what gives you sort of a calm when you're shooting and an interest, because you say, what's that about? What's going on there? And it may be that then I go to the wider shot and I get the relationship between you and your cat, mm-hmm. who is pretending not to look at you right now, but listening to everything you say. See? Yep.
Ready?
And now she looked at you. She's like, yeah, show me some attention, but not too much.
Usually it's a matter of wanting just not that. If I take this cat, this is actually Natalie's cat.
Yeah.
I sort of adopted father kind of thing. But if I pick her up, I have to feed her. That's the rules she sets.
Nice.
For the honor of picking her up. I just want also, like, just so people have a sense of this sort of collage. I don't want to call it a montage. That's completely misleading.
Yeah.
But it feels like, and also the multiple, I skip around sometimes in my head as things, and then I can edit a little. But, and also watching it multiple times now, it just sort of coalesces in a way that, because, you know, you're not sure where you're going each moment, and
right.
so you're interrupted, and then you're back.
Yeah,
but then
right.
you start to feel a sense of what's...
It's accumulating into something.
It's accumulating into something,
yeah.
exactly. Yeah.
Well, and that was, you know, we searched for many ways to translate what I experience. And certainly one of them is dropping into something I don't understand and then being pulled from it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that sort of randomness, or there's, you know, you're going from one place to another, you're in Bangladesh, no, you're in Ohio, you know, that back and forth that I experience, we wanted the viewer to have a sense of that.
Right.
And then suddenly to realize something was sort of gaining on you, which is certainly what I've experienced in the process of making this film, is that, you know, I've traveled to 86 countries in the world, and at a certain point you start to see systems.
Yeah.
And things, you know, where it would be that you would come to a place and everything would seem new,
mm-hmm.
suddenly you're saying, it sort of slots in and you understand the way corruption works in this place, or it
yeah.
slots in and you understand
yeah.
how, you know, poverty affects this particular woman who's trying to have a baby in this place.
Yeah.
And it just drops in, and sometimes the weight of it is just staggering.
Yeah. And you're carrying that around. It's a responsibility.
Yeah. Because, you know, absolutely. Because, you know, I mean, the fact is we who have the capacity to get on planes,
mm-hmm.
go places, leave places, that's a power, a privilege, right? We who carry cameras, and now I would say everyone who has a phone in their pocket is a camera person, that's a privilege to have that.
Citizen journalism.
Yeah, you know, I mean...
saying that ironically.
I do love the global citizen. I do love the sort of...
Yeah.
That idea that we are all of this world,
mm-hmm.
and that we all are observers and have the capacity to make work that will remain beyond us, or that will illuminate
mm-hmm.
something that we didn't understand.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of a weird contradictory thing to say, but I do feel like camera person is that for me. Camera person illuminated something I didn't understand about myself. I don't recognize camera person. It doesn't look like a movie I would have made.
Hmm.
It's very unfamiliar to me.
That's kind of cool.
In its form. It's so cool.
Yeah.
You know, in every way, I don't recognize it.
And it's so... embraced. I mean,
yeah.
you know.
Well, that's been really fun.
Yeah. It's been shortlisted, for God's sake, by
yeah.
the way.
Madness.
And then we meet the Bosnian family who kind of bookend the film. There's those moments, just accidents that happen. You know, I don't know, when you're pointing your camera in Missouri, there's all of a sudden...
A strike of lightning.
Yeah. You know, which yeah. I'm assuming you didn't set the camera up to try to catch lightning.
I was trying.
Were you trying to catch lightning?
I was trying to catch lightning, and it kept
eluding
me.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I would do frame, and then it would strike just outside of the
yeah,
frame, and
of
I was like, "Come on!" You know.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we needed to get back. The light was failing. No one really wanted a lightning strike except me. And so the director's antsy, yeah. and you're just like, "But we're gonna get a lightning strike." We finally got one. It's like trying to film birds or wind.
Sure, of course. Or the cat. You take a picture. The cat been looking at me for 20 minutes, but if I take the camera out and I point to the cat's going to look away.
Yeah.
It's like knows it's like a celebrity.
Yeah.
Doesn't want you to have the shot.
Right, and I do love that. I do think that there's like there must be magical trickster power to the subject avoiding you. Yes.
And then there's some very difficult scenes of the two towns of from the two towns of Jasper, another great documentary. I'm just describing so people get a sense of what we're talking about.
Yeah, there's a real range.
And then the scene with Michael Moore we described where we didn't really describe it, where he's talking to a soldier who is just telling him that answering his question about whether he would go back to another tour of duty and saying that he would refuse at any cost.
Well, and what's amazing is that that's Abdul Henderson, and I hadn't seen him since we filmed him in 2004, and I met him only a couple of months ago, and I had sent him a copy of the film and gotten his permission to have his image in the film. But I hadn't met him. And he basically told me, he ended up telling me that he made the decision not to go back to Iraq in the middle of that scene. He had spoken it to no one, which is, it's a really serious thing. He was still in the military at that moment. And for him to say publicly that he wasn't going to go back to Iraq is, a life-altering sentence.
Oh, it is.
Totally.
That could be the moment that defines his life.
And he did it in that moment. And none of us knew it. We thought
he
had
knew
done it.
It
before.
He just didn't know he knew it, maybe.
Exactly.
But maybe Michael Moore gave him the strength for that moment to crystallize because, he was just like Michael Moore's here. It's safe to say this.
That's right.
I think
what is true in that is that there's so many interesting things in that. That ended up being true. Because he said it in that public platform to Michael Moore, and because Michael Moore is, in fact, an incredibly responsible person, Michael backed up that moment with
offering
contacts to lawyers, and Abdul reached out to them.
Oh, great.
And then Fahrenheit did what it did. It premiered at Cannes and had this big public presence. And apparently, Abdul told me that the military then sent to his entire unit a letter that said they could volunteer to deploy for the next deployment. So basically, they avoided the conflict that would have been
created.
And
you caught it on camera.
Yeah, but I mean, it wouldn't have happened, right? That he would have been relieved from his obligation to redeploy if there hadn't been this public moment.
Right.
But that's not always true. And I think sometimes people think, because I'm being filmed, because I'm being recorded, I will be safe. And I think we're entering into territory where we know that's not so true anymore.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Let's face it, even the people that are supposed to protect us are on camera killing people for some reason. Michael Moore, if you think about it, does he understand that, has he slowed down enough in the moment to understand the complexities of what we just described, that he...
Right.
That was him.
Yeah.
If it was, I'm sorry.
I think it's kind of too much to take in a certain level. It's too much responsibility to bear.
Where will it bring you if just knowing that? You got to just continue onward.
But that's kind of what happened with me with this film.
Yeah.
I was continuing on. And this film was a reckoning for me of much that I had not just looked at hard.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're looking at me hard.
No. I'm also thinking, I was wondering if, there's a very, then, as you described before, there's jarring moments where you're working, you're in these extremely intense spots, locations, doing incredibly intense work, and then it ends in, maybe for the moment or for the film, and you go home.
Exactly.
And then... You have to calibrate accordingly, and then we see something that is possibly the most intense of all, which is your mother's dementia, which you caught in this very important phase where she's on the precipice here. Mm. It's incredible, because I remember that with my mother too.
Mm.
So it especially resonates, and I've talked about this a couple of times on the in conversations.
What was revealed to you by your mother's Alzheimer's that you didn't know about her? Anything?
Well, about my mother as opposed to our relationship?
Either.
Because one thing which sounds cliche, but is the, I'll start from here, is that all of the complexities and the baggage and the resentments and all that stuff does just disappear, or at least dissolve away, because you're seeing your mother in this
vulnerable place.
So vulnerable. Going from being your caretaker to completely unable to take care of herself. And so, you know, I just let it all go.
It's strangely freeing, isn't it?
It is so freeing, yeah. And there has been no struggle, you know, the cliche about she wants your lap. The cliche about there's the disappointments in about that's something about you know, never having resolved and having those things, or trying to have that conversation. It's okay, because we know. And every time, even though she doesn't know my name, she doesn't know who I am in relation to her. One thing I know she does know is that she loves me to this day, and she'll say it.
Yeah.
So all she can kind of say, more or less, is she'll say, I love you.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah, it's her, because that's kind of the loving person she was, you know.
What I found so extraordinary about it is the way that you learn how many different ways a person knows you and loves you.
Yeah.
So we have one moment where I was stroking my mother's hair, and she said, oh, has Kirsten gone? And I said, no, I'm right here. And she said, oh, that's so funny. Your touch was reminding me of you.
Yeah. That's very familiar. It's a disconnect that you can't really understand. The disconnect that is going on in people that have this. I wish I could remember more of the things my mother would say, but it's very true. For you, the listeners of FilmWax Radio, Warby Parker is offering a free 5-day home try-on to give you the opportunity to check out their glasses. I personally love the idea of getting my frames sent to me at home so I can have all my friends survey the glasses with me and help me make my choice. But to get your home try-on today, go to warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio. Again, that's warbyparkertrial.com/filmwaxradio. For your free 5-day home try-on. I moved in with them for a while.
Oh, wow.
Because my dad was completely, you know, overwhelmed and didn't really have a plan.
Yeah.
It just kept kind of going day by day, you know, for the long time. And he was also spending a lot of money. She had no problem for a long time with me. She knew who I was, and she looked to me for help. And she, but with her, she had in her mind she was married, but that this guy that was taking care of her and that was living there was not her husband, but was pretending to be.
Oh.
And there was a series of them every day. Different guy would come in, so it freaked her out.
Yeah, it's scary.
But then she would also feel worried for them. She didn't want to make them feel bad, but she didn't want them around. She wanted her husband back.
Wow.
Even though she knew he was Bob on a certain, so this disconnect between the present and the memory, which is really long-term, what we call long-term memory, the present moments, this cascade along splinters apart. You can't organize that. And then if there's but you do have the long-term memory, you know who the people in your lives are for the longest time until you don't.
Well,
I
think I've always been someone who thought a lot about past, present, future, because I was raised so religiously and raised with this idea that I would, go to heaven and there would be a place that would go on forever.
Yes.
Which I was deeply overwhelmed by and sort of freaked me out. Like the idea of, I really struggled with the idea of infinity as a child. That was a thing that I was always thinking about, infinity.
Sure.
But then combined with my mom's Alzheimer's, I think it's really actively led me to think about memory in certain kinds of ways. I'm getting
With your permission.
No, of course. Yeah. Okay. But so, you know, I think a lot about memory when I film also, sort of how does it function and what's the relationship of the past, present, future. And I've been thinking about the fact that directors have a different relationship to past, present, future than the camera person does, than the sound person does, that we all have a relationship to it, but each role sort of shifts your relationship to time. And so the camera person is, the obligation is to be as present in the present as possible. You're holding on to the future because you know the material has to be edited. So you are thinking about cinema language and, you know, have I covered the scene? Those kinds of ideas go through your head, or will my battery run out? Those kinds of ideas are in your head. But you're basically trying to be in the moment as much as possible. And the director is too, but the director has to be thinking where we're going next.
Oh, yeah.
Right. they're sort of scattered all over the edges of the present.
Yeah.
But they have to be so tuned in that if they see that you're missing what they care about in the present, that they redirect you, mm-hmm. you know? I think a lot about that, and it's been so interesting, people's different responses to camera person, but there was one person who said, oh, it's structured like Alzheimer's is structured. And I was like, what? And then, you know, just the fragmentariness of it, the way in which things with emotional resonance come up and matter the most, that they are out of chronological order, that context is fairly irrelevant, mm-hmm. that certain themes start bubbling up, you know, so that this theme of who is my husband? Do I want to be with a man or not be with a man? That is a theme for your mother. Mm-hmm. You know, a theme for my mother was thinking about what did she believe? You know, and at a certain point she asked me, are your parents still so religious? And it was so great for me to hear her say that, because she had been religious my entire life. And I always sort of wondered if there was a part of her that doubted. And it was so fun to hear the part of herself ask, like, those people over there, are they still so religious? And I was like, I don't know. Are you? And she said, well, I know they were really sincere. And I just, so great to hear
that.
Wow. Yeah.
So let's just fill in a little bit of history. So you were born and raised in the West?
I was. I'm born and raised in Seattle, Washington.
Oh.
Yeah. But my mother grew up in Wyoming.
Okay.
And she was the daughter of a sheep rancher. And that ranch was sold early before I was born. But we would occasionally go out and visit the ranch that some other people owned.
Was her family still nearby? Is that?
No. Her parents died.
Wyoming.
Her parents died. I mean, it was a real pilgrimage for her. She still had a sister there for a while.
Okay.
And a niece. But the ranch where my mother grew up was called Headquarters. And wherever we would travel in the world, my mother would say, it looks like Headquarters. You know, and we'd be like in Ireland and it would look nothing like Headquarters.
But it was the
place that resonated the most for her. Yeah. And I love that it's called Headquarters because it really was her headquarters.
Mm. So you never lived in Wyoming.
I never lived in Wyoming. No,
okay.
I always lived in Washington State. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
A lot of people have made that, you know, it's one of the mm-hmm. unexplained things in the film that if you tried to draw the conclusions, you wouldn't be quite on, but
right.
I'd have to leave some mystery.
Which I guess you're kind of undoing this thing, but
yeah,
hopefully by the time this plays.
Oh, there's plenty of mystery to go around.
Yeah. And so when did you come to New York?
I came to New York late. I mean, I basically grew up in Seattle, went to the East Coast for the first time to college. I went to Brown University.
Oh, right.
And
mm-hmm.
after Brown, I went to live in Dakar, Senegal. And I lived in Senegal for 2 years. And then after that, I went to France, where I went to film school. And I lived in France for 7 years. So I didn't come to New York until the late 90s.
Mm-hmm. Where'd you go to film school in France?
I went to La FEMIS, which is the French National Film School, and I studied cinematography there.
I think I knew
there.
This. Yeah,
yeah.
I forgot.
It's in the KJ mythology.
I'm so curious. I know there's other stuff in the mythology we'll maybe just touch on if we get a minute. But and then you started to make documentaries. How long after you moved to New York?
Immediately.
Was there any other option for you?
I honestly had failed at making a fiction film. and it had been really devastating emotionally to me. I mean, I came with a film that I had shot, a film called Foreign Body, mm-hmm. which I had shot over the course of a year in France, and I was trying to edit it and not succeeding, and I came to New York and met a friend who is still a friend named Yasmin Amatai, who was at that time an assistant for Scorsese in the edit room, and she and I tried to solve the puzzle of this movie that was deeply unsolvable. You know, it was just one of those productions that mm-hmm. never made sense, and we couldn't make it make sense. But I was really emotionally hit by the failure of trying to make a very ambitious fiction film. It was, mm-hmm. you know, it was sort of a science fiction, you know, timeless, and you know, dozens and dozens of people in it and dozens of locations, this sort of epic project that I had undertaken in video a little bit a la Lars von Trier two yeah. years before Lars von Trier, but I was out of sync with lots of what was going on in the world, and it didn't coalesce. And I felt like I'd let so many people down.
It's a lot of...
It's just such an incredible... Yeah, and, you know, I mean, I think in filmmaking, we're so aspirational. We so want to make these epic... You know, you're like, Apocalypse Now is the film I want to make. You know, you're a 20-year-old who's barely experienced anything, but you're imagining you can make Apocalypse Now.
Sure.
And so I had sort of done that and was really just exhausted by the weight of failing to make that into a finished film. And someone who I'd met and loved in college was James Forman Jr., whose father was James Forman, the civil rights activist who mm-hmm. was the executive director of SNCC, which was, you know, this voting rights organization. And he had begun to work as a public defender in Washington, D.C. And I was really compelled by, oh, that little thing called the mass incarceration of African Americans that was happening in the 90s that, you know, was so shockingly horribly wrong, and mm-hmm. so clearly so horribly mm-hmm. wrong, that I thought, okay, let me make a film about this. Let me follow James for a year in his work with juvenile offenders. And that was just, it was so compelling. I mean, that's the thing that happens to me when I film, is suddenly you want to be a public defender. You know, suddenly you want to be a surfer. Suddenly, mm-hmm. you know, you're so compelled by watching people doing what they do at the height of their game and the way in which they are committed to it, mm-hmm. that you want to be in that world and do that. And so that experience of the taking away of the anxiety of the responsibility of directing, even though I was directing, because it was all real. You're not asking actors to be a public defender. They are public defenders. That just caught me up immediately in fascination. And I worked on that project with Katie Chevigny, who is part of Big Mouth Productions and who at the time was partner with a woman named Julia Pimsler, and they just started Big Mouth Productions. And we all started making each other's films. Mm-hmm. So... I shot Julia's film. Okay. It was like a collective. We all changed roles, basically.
Right, I understand. So you did direct.
Yeah. So that was my first film. So I came and directed, and it was on HBO, and we went to Berlin, and it was a real film, right?
You know? And then you were in demand.
And then I was in demand, and then I was compelled by all of these other projects, because, you know, I would never take myself to China. I would never take myself to a separatist Christian
right. and you were already
cult in Alaska. Yeah.
Predisposition, because you'd spent time in Africa and in Europe already. So
yeah.
Clearly you
I love
that.
To travel. Yeah. Love well, it. Yeah. Love it. So somebody says, I want to go to this place. And you say, really? You're taking me to Myanmar? Okay, I'm coming.
And, you know, since we brought it up, another aspect of camera person is this, you know, you may be in Brooklyn, you may be in some small town in Bosnia or wherever. There's a leveling.
Yes.
Which is very nice. And
yes.
And everything then feels closer to you.
Absolutely.
Less distant. Everything feels a little bit more familiar.
Everything's and personal.
Universal and
everything's
personal.
Everything's personal.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. So that's a nice takeaway, I guess, from
yeah.
it. It really feels... This film, you know, you get that sensation. And mm-hmm. again, having just seen it more than once, you begin to figure these things out in a, or how to articulate them
yeah.
in a way, you know, which is
Well, I'm so, you know, I struggled for a long time to use voiceover on the film and to try to describe and explain. And I'm just so grateful to all of the people who supported the idea to make it without voiceover, which was a radical choice and one which it was unproven. We didn't know whether it would work and we didn't know whether people could relate to it or not. But I'm just so deeply grateful that that's the way we went because it actually allows images to speak in the way that they speak differently than words do, to have sound impact us emotionally that is different than the way words impact us.
You ever go to a foreign country and there's two types of visitors. There's the kinds that hire the tour guide and there are the types that go on their own. Not to say you can't occasionally do both, but I'm trying to make a big sound smart here for a moment.
Are so over, my man.
Trying to make a sound smart here, but when you are your navigator,
well,
it's a different, very different.
Well, the third way I would say, which is when you're there working, which is what I, you know, why I have gone and shot in so many different places. It is so extraordinary what working in a place allows differently than being your own guide or being.
Well, I'm
a
not
tourist.
Talking about you.
Right.
Well, I'm talking about the viewer.
Come on, it's all about me, baby.
Well, I'm talking about the viewer
yeah.
who is experiencing your film without the
right.
the voiceover.
Right.
Which means that they don't have the guide. They're figuring it out on their own. So when it's like visiting as being a tourist, but without the tour guide.
Yeah.
So you're kind of discovering them in your own way.
Yeah.
Which is at once unsettling and also very gratifying.
Right. Yeah.
And I do. And by the way, it's not like there aren't street signs. You have title cards, which
kind of
put you.
A few road maps. Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely. Where you know where you are, sometimes with whom, you know, it's
absolutely.
Helpful.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, we definitely didn't want people to be lost, but we did want people to experience those feelings of dislocation and the necessity of being nimble on your feet. Mm-hmm. You know, if you are in a place where you don't know what's going to happen mm-hmm. and you don't understand the references, then it all becomes more acute. It's all heightened, which I think, as you know, in some strange way, having lived through the Alzheimer's of your mother, there's something very acute, heightened. And certainly we all know, those of us who have lived through the death of someone we love very much, the period of time around the death, everything is crystalline and heightened. You know, that incredible book of Joan Didion's, The Year of Magical Thinking,
yeah.
I think
great
it's
book.
One of the rare, you know, pieces of literature that actually translates that state. But that state, that very acute, tuned-in state, is often what I experience while filming,
mm-hmm.
Where you just, you're all of your senses are alive by necessity.
Mm. Is it very hard to look at those scenes of your mom or where is she now?
Where is she now? That's a great question.
Internally and externally.
You know, her ashes are still in the cupboard in the living room of our house in Seattle.
Okay.
And I was just there a few days ago and had this extraordinary moment where I was with my dad was in the living room and we're thinking about potentially selling the house that we've had for 50 years. And I was trying, my kids were there playing in the living room and I was trying not to cry. But I really felt overwhelmed by the loss of this place that is, you know, so meaningful to all of us. And I looked across and saw that my father was also trying not to cry. And then that did it. And I just had just one very small tear going down my face. And Viva, my daughter, came over and started brushing my hair. And she's never done that before. And it was so in the space somehow of the chain of my mother, you know, the scene and camera person is of her talking about how my hair needs to be brushed, brushing my hair for me while I am filming. It's a theme in our lives, like we were talking about the themes, you know, that you found with your mother. But that way of comforting, the story I told you earlier about me stroking my mother's hair, it's an idea of how you comfort someone.
Mm-hmm.
And somehow my daughter knew
in that moment to comfort me, even though she couldn't understand what was going on. And this is the kind of thing that I love about life, and that I find expressed in documentary work much of the time, this sort of magical, how does this person know to do that in this moment? Because it helps. As I stroke the cat.
As you stroke the cat. The cat, which allows you to stroke it to give you comfort too.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. relationships, baby. We're all in relationships.
Yeah. So speaking of that, and your kids, who have been talked about on this podcast before, by the way, but from other filmmakers.
Well, really? Who talked
life
about my children?
Life and Happiness. Yeah. Viva and Felix, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Felix and Viva.
Yeah.
Your twins, which you, you know, are a public record about. You have talked about it.
Yeah.
And that you met Ira Sachs on a trip, on one of the, at a festival.
Yeah.
At a film festival, right? And you guys, your friendship evolved, and next thing you know, you're deciding to.
Well, it's a crazy story, honestly. I mean, it's a miraculous story. So I co-parent Viva and Felix with Ira Sachs and Boris Torres. They're a married couple, and both of them are artists. Yes, and I actually met Ira at the Venice Film Festival. We were there to support Karim Aynouz, who's an incredible filmmaker, who we were both friends with, but we'd never met, and we had a great long dinner party, and I missed my boat going back to my hotel room. And Ira said, you can stay where I'm staying. And it's such the perfect metaphor, because I really did miss my boat in waking up early enough to have children in a conventional way. Yeah. And Ira sort of, you know, gave me safe haven. yeah, but we were actually at a Sundance party, and Lisa Collins, years after the Venice event, and Lisa Collins, who's also a filmmaker I've worked with, knew that both of us were wanting to have children and introduced us again. But it wasn't a long-term relationship that it was based on. Right. We began the relationship thinking about the possibility of having children together.
I see. So you found an egg donor and a sperm donor, essentially, right?
Well, and
Ira.
Yeah.
Being Ira. And so I wasn't sure who it was.
Yeah.
Ira at birth.
That's on public record, too, although maybe.
Yeah, we can leave that out.
You leave it out. They don't love to have it in.
Okay. No, it makes sense to be
a little more
careful,
discreet about
cautious
it.
Cautious and discreet. And then you gave birth to these twins.
I know.
And they are now how old?
They are almost five. Their birthday is in January.
Coming right up. And then for a while, right after you gave birth to them, you actually all lived together for a while, or maybe even before that.
The first year.
You lived together. And then the apartment next door, and this is in the village, right?
Yeah.
This is near.
Yeah.
Okay. And I think it was around the corner from my parents'.
Yeah.
Place in Manhattan. Huh. So you, the apartment next door opens up and you move in next door.
Yeah.
And then you just started to have an arrangement.
Yeah, the kids go back and forth every other night, and
seamless.
Seamless, actually.
I mean, you can't really think of a better.
It's pretty extraordinary.
Way
yeah,
we've to had make that. Work.
Yeah, we've had exactly. We've had several kids who've come over on playdates, go home, and tell their parents, "How come I don't have two dads? Or how come I don't have two apartments?" I mean, there's a richness to it, and a multiplicity and an expansion to it that's pretty remarkable. And it's certainly, you know, I mean, I think being a woman and being a camera person is something that a lot of women find difficult to imagine because of how much traveling is involved and just the unexpectedness and the, you know, unpredictability of the schedule. Mm-hmm. And it really has been remarkable to have two other parents upon whom I could depend, given the unpredictable nature
and
of documentary work.
Even, I mean, I don't know Boris's schedule, but I do know, Ira has shot the last couple of films locally.
In New York,
which makes a big difference, too.
Both
I was an extra
in
Love
present.
Is Strange.
Nice. Where? Were you in the party scene? I was in the party scene.
No. I was in the gay bar at the end, Julian's.
Nice.
Julian's or Julius's? I can't remember.
Julius. Yeah.
But I was sitting next to John and
Alfred Molina.
And because I sat directly next to them, the shots came from the other side. And so all you see is my ear, I think.
But you can recognize
the guy
yourself,
I was talking
right?
to,
who one of us was picking up the other, I guess, was in our scene, was completely visible. So had I been sitting on the other stool, I would have had that scene. Do you regret that? No, I don't. I absolutely do not, because I sat next to them, Albert and John, and I heard their dozen takes and how incredible both of those actors are, and how every take was just so great. I'm not exaggerating. It was just great to watch these two guys, these veterans, keep doing the scene and just to get that close of a. So I was, even though I wasn't in the shot, I still had. I was there.
You were there.
I was right there watching these two pros. It was fun. And then at the very last penultimate scene where John walks, they're walking to the subway. In fact, Alfred is walking John to the subway. They kiss goodbye at the West 4th Street subway. And I think it's John goes down the steps. I can't remember who it. I haven't seen it in a while. But I'm walking right. I walk by.
Oh.
And then, so you can see, in the background me walking. So as if being an extra, that was very gratifying. And then, of course, you learn that John's character dies. And then there's the last scene that in that film. It's a great
very emotional.
With the young boy and the painting that he comes in. So that has to be a great, because then you have, it worked out if you have to travel. But I was thinking, even if you're going off to some foreign country, the world is so much closer together, and it seems, you're not going for months at a time. You're talking about...
Exactly.
You're usually, I'm sure, maybe gone a week at the most.
Yeah, but these things are all, they're difficult for all of us as adults to negotiate with parenting.
I got a call from my ex-wife, while I'm here, because we're figuring out the next few days with our son.
Exactly. It's complicated.
And I'm living with, somebody, and...
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So the other thing I was going to bring up, I don't know if this will make the podcast, but I think I might have mentioned in an email, is Ira's sister, Lynn.
Yeah.
So I don't know if, I hope you can come on February 25th, if you're in the city.
To the screening of that film?
To the screening of her new film, Tip of My Tongue, which is going to be, I think, I don't know your age, I'm not asking, but it was
51.
The subject, okay, perfect, because we're the same age.
Yeah.
It's all about these different people who turn 50 and where they're at. Like looking back, so it kind of deals a little bit with what we're talking about in the past, but very much about the moment and where we're at emotionally in our relationship to our pasts, which you always have, because we are nothing but a collection of moments of our past. But I have no idea what to expect. I don't know how much I'm in. I don't know. I just know I was one of the subjects, and I don't really remember what I said anymore, because it was like a year and a half ago.
Right.
But I'm very excited that it got into Doc Fortnight.
I know, it's
and
so
it's the
cool,
closing night film.
Yeah.
So
she's a really interesting filmmaker.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think she's always worked around ideas of memory and family. And it's interesting, I gained all of this family in this arrangement, and I didn't know Lynn's work before, and so it's been wonderful to discover it. I really liked
it. And Mark, too?
Yeah,
Mark
exactly.
Street, her husband, is another...
Just a world of people
and
making things.
We're all the
things.
Same age, and I went to Bard at the same time that Mark went, but we didn't know each other.
Oh, interesting.
Interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, a camera person, so it is just to... Let's wind it down,
I guess.
Let's
wind it down.
Because you have places to go... Yeah. You've given me so much at the time, and you've come all the way out. I really appreciate it. It's been better than I could have expected talking with you. And really, it makes me, I'm wondering, why do I keep doing this?
Right. Well, I think
that's,
and then you remember why you love it.
Yeah.
I think is that's when you. I mean, that's what the work gives, and that's what I rediscovered in the editing of Camera Person. At a certain point, I really felt overwhelmed with, this world is so hard, and all this work that we're doing is not making any difference, and where's the change? Here you're trying to work for human rights and positive change over the course of 25 years, and you see no progress on a certain level, and then it was in looking back at the footage that I say, oh, look at all of this evidence of these beautiful human connections. And that is real, and that mattered to me, and that matters to me, and that makes the hard work gratifying.
I don't think anything more. I mean, what more could sum that up the way you just described it than going back and 5 years later meeting with this Bosnian Muslim family who
you know, survived ethnic cleansing and returned to their home and are in the film and welcome you back in and just sitting around watching the footage of, you know, your clips or the footage from 5 years before, like every family, they look just like every American family. It's an incredible,
Really, I had been thinking that the film was all about me dealing with the past, you know, thinking about my mother and thinking about all the things I'd filmed. But the mother of that family basically says to me, you know, your children will see this. They will understand who you were. And it was literally in that moment that I realized, oh, this film will exist in the future. I will not exist at some point, but the film will exist. Yeah. And that was incredibly just thrilling to realize that it was, you know, it had this momentum. And she gave me that moment of, yes, I am doing this, thinking of who my children will be, of what the future will be, and that there will be some evidence of what we of this generation lived through and who we were.
There's a whole other chapter to the fact that this is distributed by Janice and the Criterion Collection. It's going to be on the Criterion Collection, which is pretty remarkable, but that's where you will see it. Is it on Filmstruck or is it going on Filmstruck?
Yeah. Okay. I think it's going to be there. Yeah,
which is the new Criterion streaming service. So it's already had theatricals. It's now going into, it's been through the festivals. It's been.
Yeah. Well, actually, IFC is bringing it back for the Late Show the next couple of weeks here in New York.
Oh,
yeah.
Great.
Yeah. Isn't that
That's
amazing?
Perfect.
I know.
So
it's starting December 30th. It'll be playing at 10 p.m.
Okay.
So we can spread the word on
that. Oh, dear.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I'm going to do, I wasn't going to post till before the new year, but what I'll just do is I'll post immediately.
Just say a little hey, shout out.
Oh, I'll totally spread the word, promote, but I'm going to put the show up. I think this will be the first show of the new year.
Oh, that's exciting.
And we'll take advantage of it. It's going to be at the IFC Center for how long?
It's going to be at least for a couple weeks, I think. Yeah.
That's great. Depending on how many people go see it.
Exactly.
Right, you know, it could be there for a while. That's great. And it's been shortlisted for, you know, the documentary category of the Academy Awards, which is no small thing. This could be a big deal, you know? I think we have a contender here.
No comment.
No comment. Wise. All right. Well, we'll sit down at some point again and look back and
see where we... We'll do the past, present, future thing all over again.
Exactly.
Right on. This has been great. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Remember, it's a new year. We're going to be doing our Kickstarter momentarily. But in the meantime, go to the iTunes and page, if you will, and please do subscribe. Leave a nice comment. Please leave a star rating. There's not many of you have done it, as you know, as I chant every episode. So this is your occasion to send me a nice gift for the new year and put your thoughts about the show up on the iTunes page for others to read. And the star ratings, the more people that do that, and, you know, assuming you get good star ratings, I mean 5 out of 5 mostly, you can be more identified by other people who like similar types of podcasts. They'll find Film Wax Radio, and you'll be part of that reason that they find it, because you helped me out. I did mention just a moment ago that I will be doing a Kickstarter campaign, so start to think about it. Just a couple of bucks even will be a tremendous help. I'm not setting a large goal. But Daddy needs a new pair of shoes. Well, no, what Daddy needs is a new setup here. And yes, I do shows out of the studio, but just as often I'm doing them at a home or in someone's office. So I need all new equipment to really do be more efficient and work quicker and more effectively. So I'm going to reach out to my audience to help me out this time. And I would dig it if you could throw me a couple of bucks. So thank you for considering that. This year, we just have, I think it's going to be our most spectacular year as a podcast in terms of the kinds of guests and in terms of the kind of quality show that I plan to deliver. I can tell you that just coming up in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have Asghar Farhadi, who has A Separation of the Past and About Ellie. He has a new film coming out this month in January called The Salesman. And I saw it and just utterly loved this film. I think he's one of the most talented filmmakers working today. That's why I stuck my neck out and got him when he was in town a few weeks ago. And I'm proud to say that they came out pretty well. And in addition to Asghar, we also have a conversation coming up with Abel Ferrara. We have a conversation coming up with Nick Flynn, the author Nick Flynn, and many more things. I've got the guys from this podcast called La Grande Bouffe coming on, Cole Smithy and Mike Lacey. I've got a number of other filmmakers coming on and actors, lining them up as we speak. So the shows ahead should be pretty, pretty darn good. We'll try to keep up the level of quality and entertainment that you're accustomed to. You can reach us with comments, of course, by reaching out to our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmwaxradio, and as well as on Twitter and Instagram. In both cases, our handle is @filmwaxradio. And of course, you can go to our website, filmwaxradio.com, and there is even a link to how to email us, me, Adam Shartoff, your host. Filmwax Radio continues to be part of the Showbriz Studios podcast network out of the East Village in New York City, and presented by Rooftop Films. And we're going to be coming at you all year long with brand new shows, old friends and new, here on Filmwax Radio. Thank you very much. I wish you guys a very, very fruitful, healthy, hopeful year ahead. But in the meantime, of course, take care of yourself and the ones you love.
Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs.